Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. Founded by a leading family in the diamond industry for more than a century, we're experts in lab-grown diamonds because that's all we do. Clean Origin, the only diamond jewelers who give you a 100-day, no-questions-asked return on your purchase. Head to cleanorigin.com or one of our retail stores and mention code RADIO10 for 10% off your purchase. That's cleanorigin.com, code RADIO10.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer? Whenever I want?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. 94% of Sleep Number smart sleepers report better sleep. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. To find a store near you, visit sleepnumber.com.
In our current tornado and severe thunderstorm warning system, if you are put under a warning, there is no question that you should take action and protect yourself and your property. But what if the warning is posed with a probability of the storm making a severe impact? Would you be more or less influenced to take action? What about if you own a business and have to make a decision not for yourself, but your employees and customers? A lot of questions. We've got just the guy here on the show today that can give us more insight on those answers. Dr. Kevin Simmons, who is a professor of economics at Austin College, focuses on natural hazards, and he's here with us today on Weather Geeks. Dr. Simmons, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's quite an honor.
I normally start the podcast, and I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to it, but I always start the podcast by asking, how did you become a weather geek? But in this case, I'm talking a sense to an economics geek who also thinks about the weather. So tell us about the convergence of those worlds in your career.
Well, first of all, this academia is a second career for me. I was born and raised in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and I worked for a large electric utility in downtown Dallas for many years. And about halfway through my career, I'd been with them for about 16, 17 years, had an opportunity to leave. There was a lot of downsizing going on in companies in the 1990s, and I took one of the buyouts and had decided that I wanted to be to go and get my PhD in economics. One of the groups I've been working in was a research-oriented group at TU. And so I rubbed elbows with all of these PhD types. And so I went out to Texas Tech in Lubbock. I was married, had kids, you know, was trying to find that balance. And along the way, I came to meet a gentleman named Kishore Mehta, and anybody in the weather community knows Kishore. Texas Tech has perhaps one of the strongest wind engineering programs, and Kishore was in a bind. He had a National Science Foundation grant that he was doing in collaboration with Colorado State, and he was getting some pressure from NSF to expand from engineering and start looking at societal impacts. So he came to the economics office and said, look, I need somebody to help me with this project. Give me somebody, give me anybody, just to have them come in and help us out. So I started working on that project and started doing some work with Kishore. They liked what I did. It became my dissertation. And then my first job out of graduate school was in Oklahoma City, and I arrived in 1999. Well, guess what happened in 1999?
Yep.
One of the largest tornadoes to hit central Oklahoma hit. I found myself the only economist in the state of Oklahoma that had done any work with natural hazards at all. I very quickly met Jeff Kimple at the National Severe Storms Lab. Jeff, and in doing so, I met at University of Oklahoma, Dan Sutter, who collaborated with me for many years. And Jeff said, we need you to do some work for us. So we started working on some projects. Initially, we looked at the effectiveness of Doppler radar, which was a new technology at the time. And that just led from one thing to another, to another, to another. And it's been a great ride. Now, I've recently retired. I retired recently from AC, but I still have an office on campus. I'm still doing a little bit of work, but that's how I got into this. It was purely, serendipity, if you want to think of it that way.
And we certainly, given your track record, consider you a weather geek. If you don't consider yourself one, we embrace you into our fold. Well,
thank you. That is quite an honor.
You know, you grew up in, I guess you matriculated in Texas. It has its fair share of nasty weather, severe weather. Mm-hmm. I mean, was that always a part of your marinade or DNA?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you grew up in North Texas, you're going to be exposed to violent tornadoes. You're going to be exposed to hail. Hey, we get hail more commonly than we get really bad tornadoes. And one of the big concerns for me, I was born in the Dallas area, and I can remember, you know, how the population in Dallas was fairly concentrated when I was a kid. But now North Texas is so large that I think we got about 8 million people in the DFW Metroplex. And one of my good friends, Walker Ashley, wrote a paper on what he called the expanding bullseye. And there's no better application of that than what has happened in Dallas-Fort Worth. If you get violent weather now in Dallas-Fort Worth, it's almost hard to imagine that it wouldn't cause extensive damage. So, yeah, you're used to this. But it's a real concern as we become more and more urbanized here and other places, too.
Yeah, well, we certainly have that expanding bullseye here in the Atlanta area, too. And big shout out to Walker Ashley and Steven Strader and all the folks Absolutely. That are doing that really important work. Walker, by the way, is a former alum of our program here at the University of Georgia.
I know that. I've witnessed that. Yeah, good guy. He's a great interview.
Bulldog, so, you know, we have a lot of listeners from all kinds of schools and all kinds of backgrounds, but I do slip in a Go Dogs every now and then. But I want to kind
You're
of
allowed.
Talk about,
You're allowed.
Yeah, I want to kind of talk about, and by the way, just talking to Dr. Kevin Simmons. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia. Let me tell you a little bit about Kevin's background before we dive further into the discussion. He was a professor of economics at Austin College. You did hear that he's retired with a focus on natural hazards, a former senior financial analyst at TXU Energy, and PhD in economics from Texas Tech University and a BBA in finance from the University of Texas Arlington. Now, speaking of all those numbers and economics and weather warnings, we often talk about deterministic versus probabilistic warnings. And at times, for some, the differences there can create challenges. Can you explain to this audience, and we have a wide-ranging listenership and viewership on Weather Geeks, can you explain the basic differences between a deterministic and a probabilistic warning or piece of information and why one might use one versus the other?
Yeah. The deterministic warning is the current warning that we use that everybody's familiar with. You either get a warning or not. It's binary. You're either in a warned area or you're not. Several years ago, I was fortunate to begin talking to a friend of mine who at that time was associate director at the National Severe Storms Lab, Lance Rothfuss. Lance is also retired now. But he began, and this has probably been 10 years ago, contemplating whether or not we could make a transition from deterministic to probabilistic. So he began developing what is now known as the FACET system that you may be familiar with. And so we got, and I assume what you're leading up to is the project that I did most recently, which was a NOAA-funded project. We decided to look at this from two perspectives. And by the way, my NOAA collaborator with Kim Kloko, who you also know, has also been on Weather Geeks.
Absolutely.
I'm only about 2 hours from Norman, so I can go back and forth up there fairly easily to work with the folks at the Weather Center. And so we began a project to see how would people change their response if it's a warning given to them in probabilities versus deterministic. Now, the probabilities, the nice thing about Lance's system, which is so interesting, is that it updates those probabilities as the storm gets closer and closer and closer to you. So you may receive a warning, let's say on your phone, and you get a little beep on your phone. It says, look, there's a tornado coming this way. Right now, the probability of hitting you, fairly remote, But as that storm gets closer, what happens to those probabilities? They begin to go up. And so as the probabilities go up, you can start saying, oh, now I need to pay attention. And now I have the opportunity to make some judgments about what I can do as an individual versus a business. Now, our study looked at businesses. So we were looking specifically at how they respond. And but it does a couple of things. It narrows the portion of the area that is under the warning when the warnings get high enough in probabilities that you really take them seriously. So it does something similar to what the transition from county-based warnings to storm-based warnings did. If you recall, that was, 15 years ago we made that change. A county can be a large area, but if you can draw a polygon around a smaller area, you've collapsed that area. And so this takes that one step further and says, as the storm gets closer, the probabilities get higher, that area becomes smaller yet. So as an economist, what you're interested in is there is a cost to respond to a warning. Ah. If you're an individual, the cost may be not necessarily monetary, but you're giving up something, whether your golf game or you're giving up, work and people now working from home. So there's productivity issues that may go there. For a business, it's even more than that because they lose sales if they have to shut the store down. They may have to take some precautions to protect inventory. There's all kinds of things that go into responding to a warning. So anytime we can make that more precise, we're reducing that footprint, we're reducing the societal cost, and those are the things that economists are interested in.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Back on the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia, and I'm speaking with Dr. Kevin Simmons, who is really sort of representative of what I think our discipline has become. Back when I was coming up as a young graduate student at Florida State, we talked meteorology, and it was pretty siloed in the atmospheric sciences. But increasingly and importantly, weather, risk communication, warnings, and so forth are now at the intersection of things like economy and economics and social and behavioral sciences and psychology and so forth. So Dr. Simmons is really at the forefront of where our field has moved. As we are even recording this, the AMS meeting is happening in Baltimore, Maryland, and I imagine that there will be plenty of sessions on these types of topics. And so we thank Dr. Simmons for joining us on the podcast. Now, let's talk about the studies in more details. Now, one of the things that we found in our research is that studies that you have been involved with have shown how the deterministic warning paradigm actually causes more money to be lost than probabilistic. Is that the case, or did we get that wrong?
I would say it the other way around.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking too as I read that. Maybe we kind of got in the note preparation, but I think it's the other way around, as I would guess. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. If you just, as I mentioned before, before your break, the probabilistic warnings allow us the opportunity to shrink that footprint.
Yes.
Even more. And so let me answer that question by talking about the project that we did to assess this. Now, a little background on this. Austin College is not located in Austin. So let me just put that out there. We are actually just north of the Dallas-Fort Worth area. We're about an hour north of downtown Dallas. So it'd be a little bit like Athens with Atlanta, that kind of thing. We are a traditional liberal arts college, we have a couple of graduate programs, but mostly we're undergrads. And so what I did was I took the grant money from NOAA and I used it to get undergraduates to conduct a survey. Now, I had two undergraduates that I was working with across 2 years. Excellent students. One of them is finishing up her doctorate at UC San Diego right now. The other one finished his master's and is working in D.C. What they did was they designed a survey that we were going to give to businesses. And the survey asked them a number of questions. One of them was, a little bit about the firm. Tell us how big you are, what industry you're in, so we can control for that. We also wanted to know, who is it that makes decisions about when you shut down or when you don't shut down? So we know who the decision maker is. And then we wanted to know some things about how well-trained they are in making these things. And then what kind of criteria goes into the decision? What are the factors that go into this? Then we gave them some scenarios. We said, okay, you are in a tornado has been spotted. You have been given a deterministic warning. What do you do? And so we allow them to tell us. One other thing I need to mention is, if you're in a warning, can you estimate the cost to your business of what this warning is going to entail in shutting down your operations temporarily? Then, after they had that one, we gave them a different set of scenarios. This time, they're probabilistic. Now, we had four scenarios. We said it's either a 25% probability, a 50, a 75, a 100. We randomly assigned those to the businesses so we wouldn't have any bias that's inherent when you do surveys like that. And we asked the same question. Now you've got this scenario, but it's not a deterministic warning. It's a probabilistic. So we could see, how do they change their response at low levels of probability versus high levels of probability? And then we could take the cost that they gave us. This is how much it costs to shut down, $10,000 or $5,000 or whatever, depending on the size of the business. And we could calculate what the response rate was and then what the overall cost to society was. Now, what you found was the response on probabilistic warnings. Really, it wasn't until you got above that 75% probability that the response began to mirror the response on a deterministic warning. So by the time you get to the 75% probability level, that footprint has shrunk to a much smaller footprint. So once we get this information, once we know the response rates, we can then go back into the national database and say, okay, for the tornadoes that have occurred, we know if we could shrink this down to, or if we can take what the probability area is around that that level of warning, estimate how many businesses are in a geography that size on average, and then take the amount of money they say they're going to spend. You can compare, if this is a deterministic warning, what would it cost? Given this probabilistic warning, what is the societal cost, and compare them. And we got some pretty remarkable results. What we found was that the savings to society between the deterministic warnings versus the probabilistic warnings amounted to about $5 billion a year. That's a $5 billion
saving
with a B. Wow. $5 billion with a B on an annual basis. So this is a very strong result that says there is a way to minimize the cost to society of providing warnings for inclement violent weather. And I think it did a good job of showing that that the FACET system that Severe Storms Lab has been working on for quite a while, this is a good investment. Before we published this, Marshall, we did presentations to NOAA. In fact, we had the assistant secretary who was over NOAA during that time period was in on the presentations, and I think they were pleased with the results. to show that we had these savings.
Such a fascinating discussion with Dr. Kevin Simmons. Now, I don't know how much you can generalize this result or these results from scale, but the question comes to mind, the local businesses versus corporations or large corporations. Right. And are there sort of similar type responses to savings, or do you have enough information in your study or data to sort of make that kind of conclusion?
Well, we had our response was through our survey included both very large businesses in the Dallas area to very, very small businesses in the Dallas area. And let me tell you how we disseminated the survey. We disseminated the survey through chambers of commerce, and because they had these mailing lists of all their members. And so like the Dallas Chamber of Commerce was one of our contributors. They have extremely large businesses in the Dallas area, and they go all the way down to very small. When we made our estimates of financial impact, we weighted it by the percentage of businesses in terms of size. So in other words, we said businesses of 500 employees or more represents certain percent of the number of businesses nationwide all the way down. So we were using weighted averages on this. So what we were given with that $5 billion figure is a national aggregate figure. But there is a wide difference in how businesses are going to have to respond. Small businesses, there's probably very little in the way of lost revenue and so forth. I'm thinking mom and pop kind of shops, and they don't have a lot of employees. But you mentioned an Amazon facility. Just imagine what it takes to shut down a large facility like that. That is not a quick process. It's not a free process. It's quite expensive. And it can involve, you know, just a number of things that have to go forward. Think about a operation that may have inventory that is, some of the inventory is displayed outside their business. Like you can think of the obvious ones are things like car dealerships, but there's not much they can do with that. But if you've got some inventory that's outside and you have enough time that you could bring it inside, well, then there is a cost, but there's also a benefit that you may have saved damage to equipment that or product that that was vulnerable to the storm when it comes through. So depending on the size of the business, depending on what kind of business it is, there's all kinds of things that can go in there. But the really important thing to keep in mind, and this is one of the things that I found very interesting about probabilities, once they get that first warning, even if it's a low probability, it's triggered, hey, I may need to pay attention to something. And if you are a larger business, you're probably, that threshold that you start to respond is going to be lower than the threshold if you're a small business. So I think that there's a lot of opportunity there for us to see some gains as businesses, think about what do I need to do? How long does it take me to do it? And gauge my response accordingly.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we are back on the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard, and I'm talking with Dr. Kevin Simmons about the convergence of risk warnings in the weather sphere and economics. Now, I want to kind of pivot to this discussion of false alarms. I'd like for you to define for our listeners and viewers what we mean in the weather risk communication world when we talk about false alarms. And I'm curious as to what you feel from your perspective would help us reduce the false alarm rate. Is it probabilistic paradigms or other types of things that you've seen? So define what we mean by false alarms, first of all. I think people may have a general sense of what we mean. Mm-hmm. And then what can we do from your perspective to reduce them?
Well, false alarm, just very simply, is the situation where a warning has been issued for a particular area and the event didn't occur. And it's just that simple. And the Weather Service is in a real bind here. And I have, you know, I've come over the last 25 years to have such good friends at the Weather Service, and I've got such respect for the work that they do. I'm just a humble economist. These guys are the rock stars. And they're between a rock and a hard place, because if they don't offer a warning, then they are criticized. If they don't give a warning, something happened, criticism is going to fly. On the other hand, if they give a warning and nothing happens, criticism is going to fly. It's just the unfortunate nature of that job. Dan Sutter and I had been working in developing econometric models to look at how Doppler radar had improved casualties received from storms. We looked at lead time. We looked at all the metrics that are being used to see what is the effort. And so a natural extension of that was to ask ourselves, if a false alarm occurs, did it matter? Did it influence the decisions that were being made that led people to be in a safe place or a not so safe place? That's all we were trying to do. So we did conduct a study at this. It was kind of controversial at the time that we did it.
Why was it controversial?
I think that there was some sensitivity on the part that we were, there may have been a feeling that we were being critical, and we were not. We were just trying to extend the natural extension of what we were working on. And I think some of the thought was, well, these models that Dan and Kevin are using, they look at the problem from 35,000 feet, which is true. They don't really get down into the nitty gritty. To get down into the nitty gritty, you need some social scientists that do survey work, that do lab experiments. That's where you can start peeling back the onion. Our models are really good at looking down from 35,000 feet and saying, ooh, that may be a problem there. Can we do some more work on that? Well, anyway, what we found, if you want me to go into the results of what we found here.
Yeah, if you could summarize them, that would be great. I'd love to know
what we found was that if the false alarm rate goes up by, say, one standard deviation, there is a statistical increase in casualties that ranges, and we did a confidence interval, that ranges anywhere from about 15 to 35%. You know, so a midline on that confidence interval would be somewhere around 20, 23%, something like that. And it showed that people did, or it seemed to show, that if you're living in an area where false alarm rate is pretty high compared to other areas, that people over time do kind of discount the warnings.
They tune them out.
And we didn't try to go into why do they tune them out? We just said casualties go up. So something's happening. And the logical extrapolation of that is that people have tuned out the warning. And, you know, I think the average false alarm rate's around 75%. It ranges from some areas very low. Some areas, false alarm rates can be rather high. We also asked ourselves, Marshall, and this is crucial, how do people get their information? So we did the study from, we drew our geographic boundary of how to calculate the false alarm ratio based on the Weather Field Office. So North Texas is served out of the Fort Worth field office. So, you know, North Texas, But then we also said, well, a lot of people get it from TV. So now we took the Nielsen definition of what the TV broadcast area was, recalculated the false alarm rate, and came up with the same results. So whether you're getting it directly from the weather service or you're getting it from your weatherman on TV, you know, the false alarm rate appears to matter when it comes to response.
I know so many people these days, for better or worse or indifferent, get their information from weather apps. That a part of your consideration?
When we did the study, that was not a common thing. This study is about 10 years old.
Ah, yes.
So the weather apps were not a common thing, but that would be an excellent extension.
I agree, because I'm seeing such a transition in terms of how people get that information. And I've often argued that sometimes in these dynamic or rapidly changing severe weather environments, the weather apps aren't as good. They're pretty good at telling you a little sunny day and some of the sort of more sustained static weather that we expect over a day or two or three. But I often wonder about their efficacy in these dynamically evolving weather scenarios and so forth.
Right.
This is really fascinating. I'm talking with Dr. Kevin Simmons about his work. So, you know, I was just lecturing about this in my radar meteorology class at Georgia the other day. I was talking about how back in my day, a tornado, you know, a warning was if someone saw it or if there was a tornado present, but there are these radar indicated sort of circulations now because of the advances in technology. And so I've often wondered about the connections there in terms of false alarm and so forth. So what's your bottom line in terms of if you were sort of to put a sort of, if you were in an elevator with a congressperson headed to a hearing, what would you tell them about the sort of probabilistic forecast or probabilistic warning regime? What would be your sort of key recommendation?
I think we should make that transition. Mm-hmm. From what we got out of our study, I mean, even some of the more intuitive things that we didn't necessarily emphasize in the paper was it does a couple of things. We've talked today just about limiting the cost and how we limit the footprint and stuff like that. But just like I mentioned a minute ago, and I think this is critical, it gives people a heads up well in advance that is much more powerful than the tornado watch. You know, Dan and I also did some studies on tornado watches. And what we found on tornado watches was that it really, maybe it raised awareness, but you don't see a statistical change from being in a watch versus not. But what the probabilistic thing does is it's dynamic, like you said, it's changing. And as it's changing, people, you know, they get a little beep on their phone and they see a low probability, but at least their heads up. And now as that thing gets closer and closer and closer, that awareness becomes transition into action. So I think it offers us something that we don't have right now. And so if I had the opportunity to help lobby the folks in D.C. to consider expanding these programs, I think that's what I would lean on, is that it reduces cost. And I think you got to say that we're in a political environment right now where you can't make a major investment without making the economic argument. That is just the way it is.
Oh, absolutely. And we should have been doing that even before this generation that we're in. I think that's always been a very valuable and powerful argument. You know, the Weather Service is one of the biggest values that mm-hmm. our federal government offers. I don't think listeners and viewers realize that the sort of, you know, cups on of coffee per American in terms of the budget that the Weather Service operates on, I think it's about $1 billion. Is nothing compared to the economic impact of its forecast and warnings and also lives saved.
Oh, absolutely.
So I always sort of share and convey that message. So I can't let you get out of here. You mentioned you're retired. What are you doing in your retirement? What do you like to do?
Besides chasing 5 grandchildren?
well, that'll do it.
I still maintain an office at campus, and I'm not teaching. But I haven't worked on any research projects. I have some colleagues at other schools that have included me on some grant proposals. And if the grant proposals get funded, you know, we'll work on them. But I'm doing things like this. I did a podcast with IBHS about 2 months ago. Sure. Some of our insurance friends that are there. I just had a real interesting Zoom call with an outfit that is, I think they're doing the assessment on the Weather Service. I'm not entirely sure what their project is, but they wanted to get my input. So I still have friends in the community. It was such a big part of my life for 25 years. You really can't. I continue to try to be an advocate for the work that we do. I am, anytime I hear people complain about federal government or something like that, I am very quick to respond that, you know, I've been around this, the federal government involved in various agents, not just the Weather Service, but various. And I will tell them, man, these people are so good. They are so good. Yes. They're bright. They're intelligent. They care. So I try to be that advocate because I think we're in another thing about this political moment is that we've got good people that are being criticized for no reason. A lot of time it's because people just don't know. They don't know what's going on.
Yeah, I agree. I think people sort of, it's easy. People, you know, I have someone to say something, everything's local. So people just kind of pay attention to what's going on. You know, they don't even realize it in the backdrop. They're making decisions every day because of the work of our folks at the National Weather Service and NOAA, even if it comes through their app or even if it's coming through their the Weather Channel or their local. I mean, a lot of that information, those weather satellites and those models and those radars and those forecast offices are at the National Weather Service. That's the infrastructure behind all of that information that people take for granted. So I was, while you were talking, I was pulling up just to let people know, FY23 budget, I think there was a $1.4 billion increase in the NOAA budget, which was, I think, $6.9 billion. And NOAA is the parent organization of the National Weather Service. And I think of that $6.9 billion, I think about a billion, maybe a little bit more, goes to the National Weather Service. So it's a tremendous bang for your buck. Mm. Kevin, have to end it there. I could talk to you for another hour. I mean, this is just fascinating, and we'll certainly have to have you back on. And hey, I write grants too, so I may be circling back to you maybe for some of your expertise on some of the things that we do in my other hat that I wear, which is an actual research scientist myself and professor. But it's been such a pleasure to have you on the Weather Geeks podcast.
Well, thank you, Marshall. It has been a joy to get a chance to visit with you guys. You and I've never met, but I followed your work, and obviously you're one of the rock stars. So thank you, and such an honor for you having me on.
Well, you know, I'll take that compliment for sure. But I really value your work, and I can clearly see by some of the people that you mentioned, Kim and Lenz and Walker, that you're very much in the rock star crowd yourself. So again, thank you for joining us, and everyone, thanks for listening and watching the Weather Geeks podcast. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia, and we'll see you next time.